Welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is Friday the 10th of April 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAlbion.com because it's the end of the week and you know what that means. We have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II and the soon-to-be-released Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good evening, sir. How are you doing?
You say that every week. I'm nowhere near releasing it.
You must be a bit closer.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think everybody must be a bit fed up now being locked up, but, you know, we do what we do.
Have you not managed to get any further on with it then, the Churchill documentary?
Well, no, I've been working on the Stalin one.
working on the second one before you finish the first one? What's going on, Dennis?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, but... I had to go root through the internet this week to find more exclusive clues of either him being a Jew or being a Freemason or both.
I think it was disproved that he was a Jew, wasn't it? Because the logic was that his name, Dagashvili...
There you go, you see.
Was Georgian for Jewish or something, but it's not.
You're going to have to watch the video when it's finished.
Oh, there's something else, is there?
It's an
intrigue.
We don't go down that road, no.
Intrigue. Well, we'll have to wait till that comes out. And so you haven't actually managed to get any further on with Churchill then?
Unfortunately, no. The fat bastard will have to wait.
Well, it doesn't matter because we've got some different content to get into tonight, actually.
Great find. I'm thinking to... His name kind of defeats me at the moment, but he sent me a link to it and then I sent a link to you and... Suddenly, we're in heaven.
Ah, right. Well, tonight, I was going to say, because I've been looking at these books from a guy on Twitter, and he goes by the name of Rare Books WW2, and he calls it Rare Book Club. And anybody that's interested in early books, political books from 1900 onwards, racial books, politics, then they should really follow his Twitter, because he's got access to... loads of extremely rare books, and basically he collects money from people and then he buys the books, and then the people that donated the money they get PDF copies of it. And these are extremely rare books. They're not available on archive.org or places like that. He shows the pictures of them, and I've had a look at two of these books. I looked at one last week. And that one was called National Socialism and the Roman Catholic Church. That was by Nathaniel Micklin from 1939. And I was hoping we might be able to get some content from it that we might be able to use. But it was really a lot of propaganda against the National Socialists. It was basically taking the slanders and the smears against the National Socialists that have been put in the Western press and then repeating them and regurgitating them in book form and relying on people in the West really not knowing any better. So that one, I thought we would leave that one. And then I got sent one this week, which is really, really interesting. It's called From God Among the Germans by Paul F. Douglas. And it was written in 1935, so it was before the war started. It was before the big split that they had with the churches. And this book seems to concentrate on the Protestant church, which I thought was really, really fortuitous because we've done so much stuff on the Catholic Church, Dennis. We've filled up a whole section, haven't we? And we've done nothing on the Protestants. Nothing on the Protestants.
And that's, I don't think you've seen it yet, but I found a figure a while back of Hitler... a carving, along with Jesus and some Nazi soldiers, and that was supposed to be in the Protestant church in Berlin.
Oh, I haven't seen that picture. I'd like to have a look at that. I'd like to have a look at that. And another thing that I thought was really good about this book, it also talks about the 28 theses that the Protestant church had. And I was talking to you about this earlier, Dennis, and I'm sure some of the listeners probably remember, a while back we talked about Alfred Rosenberg and how it was alleged that he had rewritten the church with, or rewritten the guidelines for the church with 28 new rules, which they called the 28 theses of the German church or the Reich church. And in it, it had things like, everybody's got to pray to Hitler. We're going to put Mein Kampf on the altar instead of the Bible, and all this heretical, blasphemous nonsense, basically. And we said at the time, well, that can't be what these churchmen were doing. Only, and the reports of this were, I think, in the New York Times and somewhere else, and it was, we've discovered that Alfred Rosenberg is tearing up all the church guidelines and he's going to do this worshipping of Hitler stuff. And in this book, it actually tells you about the 28 theses of the Protestant church. And of course, they're nothing to do with Rosenberg. Nothing at all to do with what he came up with.
You've got to get alarm bells ringing when you're in New York Times, haven't you?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. It was one of the New York papers. And then looking around on the internet and trying to find out what the proper theses were, it was impossible. You just find these references to Alfred Rosenberg's thing, whatever it was. And they found it, didn't they? They found some notes and they basically said, well, this must have been what he was doing. He was going to change the church. And you don't even know if it was written by Rosenberg or not. I mean, it may well have just been black propaganda that was just designed to slander them. There's a lot of interesting stuff in this book anyway. But, I mean, what are your thoughts on the Protestant church there before we get into it, Dennis? Because, you talk about the Catholic one a lot.
Well, to be honest, the Protestant church, I think, in Europe is a different church to the British one, two different organisms, if you like. The European one was more of a break from the Catholic Church for reasons, more the fact that they felt the Catholic Church was not really preaching, going more Judaic than it should do. But in the English one, Henry VIII was a totally different raid, just a plundering job, really. But I've always felt that they were being used, as Luther found out, by the Jews to help break up the Catholic Church. So, I mean, it doesn't help when they were at the Vatican too. There were six Protestants involved in that as well. So that doesn't bode well, really. So, I can't say I'm glowing with praise. And when you look at Northern Ireland, by the way, I've always thought that, there's heavily, these Orange Lodges are heavily into Masonry. And that's another point,
And there is a lot of links between Protestantism and Judaism. And as you were saying there, the Jews actually encouraged Protestantism, and they encouraged the split within the church and the schism because they knew it would split the church up. So they were even printing Bibles at the time. But Luther, although he started out being sponsored by the Jews, he turned against them later in life, and he wrote a book called On the Jews and Their Lies. And it was, obviously, Luther was from Germany, and the National Socialists looked to Luther and his split from the church as that was the beginning of the national awakening as Germany as a nation, rather than Germany as a subsidiary of the Catholic Church. So they saw Luther in more of a nationalist light. And when the National Socialists came to power, obviously they concentrated on the anti-Jewish writings of Luther and their support for the Protestant Church. The Protestant Church was moving more in that direction, which the Anglican Church in England has never gone in that direction at all.
Oh, I've got my own versions of what the Anglican Church could well be.
Yeah, if you look at Archbishop Welby today, I mean, he's dreadful. He just repeats stuff out of the UN Declaration of Human Rights rather than actually reading bits from the Bible. But they didn't get it all right. I mean, there was bits of it where they were attacking the Old Testament and they weren't happy about St. Matthew. They weren't happy about St. Paul. And all of that comes from just not really understanding history and not really understanding the Bible. But the people that it talks about in this book, the churchmen that it talks about in this book, I mean, they're proper theologians and they're properly looking into it, but they still don't get that today's Jews are not the Israelites of old. It just seems to me that has messed so many things up people thinking that today's Jews are the old Israelites. And if you start with that premise, you're going to end up in the wrong place, because right at the start, you know, you've made a serious mistake there. Right. Shall I get into this then, Dennis?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's from a book, From God Among the Germans by Paul F. Douglas. So it was written in 1935. And the first quote that I pulled out from it is actually about the function of a citizen in the National Socialist State, which I thought was really interesting because it contrasts it with communism and liberal democracy. Blood is a precondition of citizenship, and it is organized into an organic legal entity. In place of arbitrary rules and coercion, it is said the natural law of the life of the folk rules. Tasks and duties are allocated to the individual man in the state, and each one fills his niche in the folkic whole. In this way, the German state is organized according to the Standish Ordnung. This means that the folkic comrade of the National Socialist State acts in virtue of his functional place, which comes to him within the whole, out of the obligation which is given to him as a member of the whole to administer. This conception is contrasted to the condition of the liberal state, where the citizen acted out of freedom, and the communist state, where action proceeds from coercion. This functional structure of the folk within itself means that men are organized into interest groups, and that when each man performs his big and little tasks in life according to his own training and talent, he is playing his divine and organic part heroically in the folkic existence of the German nation. The doctrine of organization based on those who give orders and those who take them, those who command and those who obey, those who lead and those who follow, those who exercise authority and those who submit to it, runs through every functional part of the new organic body. The leader is said to be a man of vitality who has the ability to judge a situation and to act with a determined will and a fighting spirit. This leader articulates the undefined yearning of the folk for the satisfaction of its inner needs. He makes plans of action and presses programs through with battering determination. Ideas and energy flow from him to the masses, which are thereby awakened to vitality and new life. And as I say, that's not written by a National Socialist. That's written by an objective observer, basically. And I thought there were a couple of things interesting in that. The citizen is acting out of the virtue of the fact that he understands that he is part of the national whole. So why would he not act in the best interests of that nation? Rather than communism, where you act because you will be punished if you don't. Or in the liberal state where, oh, you have the freedom to do this, you have the freedom to do that, you have the freedom not to act. So there are two different ways. A much better system is to teach people to do the virtuous thing, basically. And you have to do the virtuous thing. You have to look after your nation because that's where you come from. And the other bit that I thought was interesting about this is it talks about the state and the nation as if it's a body, with Hitler at the top as the head, as the leader. And that's the same sort of language as the New Testament that talks about the church as the body, with Christ as the head. And the members of the body, the arms and the limbs, are all parts of the Christian church. And you've got the same thing here happening with National Socialism, which I've always said is reflective of Christianity.
You have indeed, yeah. Well, I was just going to say, yeah, you've always said that. And I believe that to be true as well. It's talking at the end there. It is Hitler, isn't it? Leader is said to be a man of vitality, has the ability to judge a situation and act with determined will and fighting spirit. That sums up Hitler to a T.
And also, I mean, they were like praising the heroes of the past and praising the battles that they had. And they were saying, and now we live in the time that we live in, there's no more need for battles, but we still have to have that will and that courage. And when we're at work and when we're taking part in building things, even if it's just in a factory, you have to do it with that same spirit. And you have to see that what you're doing is just as important as these heroes that fought on the battlefields of the past. Because what you're doing is for the good of the nation, the same as what they were doing was for the good of the nation. They were securing territory and what have you. And it was like inculcating that spirit.
Positive thought.
And this sort of made its way, because this was so powerful, and this powerful revolution that they had, this powerful social and cultural revolution, the churchmen and the Christians wanted to bring that into the church as well. They wanted to have a revolution of the church, but the National Socialism was separate to the church. You know, remember, as Hitler said, we will do the politics and the church is responsible for the spirit of the nation, the morals of the nation. So the actual establishment of the National Socialism didn't really want to play too much of a role within the church, but the churchmen themselves did. They wanted to have this similar revolution within the church. So it wasn't a top-down thing to get involved in these churches. It was from the roots up, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But then they formed these various groups. There was the Folkic revival. There was a very minor, what we would probably call today a pagan revival. There was actually one of these pagan groups, the largest one I think was actually banned by Adolf Hitler because it had links with Freemasonry. But the Folkic idea was getting closer to nature and finding out more about what the history of the Germans was more than anything else. And that also bled into the Christian movement, which was also looking at German history and then trying to make the history of Christianity highlight the German parts of it more than mm-hmm. the international parts of it. And they formed all these various different groups. And the most important one called itself the German Christians. And I've got a quote here, which is about how they formed. And it's interesting, the people that actually took part in this. On an evening in 1930, a little group of men met in a private house in Berlin for discussion. Among the guests were Princes Eitel Friedrich and August Wilhelm, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, then editor of the National Socialist Berlin Daily, Der Angriff, and regional leader of the party, and Wilhelm Kuber, leader of the National Socialist faction in the Prussian Landtag and editor of the weekly Markischer Adler. The conversation was directed by former Count Pastor Döring with a paper by Pastor Friedrich Winnecke on his conceptions of the mission of the church in political evolution. As pastor of the cathedral in Soldin in 1919 and one of the first candidates on the National Socialist ticket in a municipal election, Herr Winnecke had wondered if the swastika could be united with the cross of Christ. He came to the conclusion that the former was just as much a symbol of the will of God as the latter was of redemption and salvation. His attitude towards the joinder of the two was set forth in an article in the Markischer Adler under the title of The Spirit of Christianity in the National Socialist Movement. The result of the mutual sharing of ideas on this night was that the group was convinced that National Socialism needed a religious substructure if it was to be enduring. This effect should be brought about within the church by an organization which would work for the same objectives within the church that the party was seeking to realize in political areas. And it must be quite honestly admitted, says Dr. Winnecke, formerly High Consistory Councillor in the Supreme Church Council and theologian of the faith movement of German Christians. It must be quite honestly admitted that the first real stimulation came from the circles of the National Socialist Workers' Party of Germany. While it was conceded that the National Socialist Party in the state and the sister movement within the church should strive towards the same goal, it was held essential that party and church affairs should nevertheless proceed separately. And what they're talking about there is that image of that you see of the cross with the swastika in it that you can find on Google Images.
Mm-hmm.
And that was how this idea came about. And he was saying that the swastika and the cross are both just as much a symbol of the will of God and also redemption and salvation.
Yeah, it's this where the pagans have claimed the swastika for some reason. And, the attempts to argue in the comment section sometimes on YouTube, on BitChute, where I try and emphasize the fact that, the swastika itself, in many countries and many cultures, and Christianity is one of them. And I actually showed a photograph. I put a video up this week called Hitler's War, The Last Christian Crusade. And the final photograph that I showed was the Bishop of Coventry in his tomb. And there's kind of obviously a statue of him on top with his fish hat. And around the fish hat, you can plainly see swastika.
It was a very common symbol used by the church up until the war. Basically, it was often used by the church. You can find it going back centuries. And when you think about it, I mean, in Germany, they call it the hooked cross. They didn't call it the swastika. They called it the Hakenkreuz. So they were calling it a cross. It is actually a form of cross that's been used by us for centuries. So what it was what they were looking at, some people would say, well, Jesus was a Jew, and to sort of take the Jewishness away from it, they would have this swastika there, a hooked cross there, and say, well, this is more German. I mean, it was wrong to think that Jesus was a Jew, but it was all about trying to make things more German, more white, more Aryan. In actual fact, I mean, the swastika is used in all different cultures. Japanese use it, the Indian use it, but it was seen as a very early Aryan symbol. So to use that and link it up with Christianity is basically saying Christianity is Aryan. It's as Aryan as this swastika is.
I mean, like I said, we talked about it maybe last week or before, where, you know, I'm not convinced that if it didn't have Christian links, that he wouldn't have been banned.
Who was that?
The swastika, you know, along with the Roman salute and all that. Obviously, they banned them in Germany, but, you know, when you dig a bit deeper and you go into what that war was all about, then, you know, I'm not surprised it's banned.
Banned everything to do with it, haven't they? Really, I mean, you can't even.
Well, they even tried banning in India at one point, and it just told them to go.
Yeah, there's a totally different opinion of Adolf Hitler in the East, isn't there? In Japan and India, they don't hold it to be a sacred element, almost like a religious element. To think that Hitler is the most evil man in the world and the sacred Holocaust of the Jews, that's how it's seen over here. But over there, it's just seen as a war. And Hitler was a great leader because it was just one small country that took on the rest of the world. So I think they admire him for that, particularly in Japan, in China. And then in India, they admire him because he helped out the Indians and he wanted to help them.
Yeah. I'm just going to say, like, I managed to get into me Dennis Wise's email account for the first time in about 4 years, believe it or not. So I had some emails in there. I think I'll never tell you about this one, where I used to have some correspondence with a guy who was a teacher in India. He sent me photographs of his classroom where he was actually teaching from The Greatest Story Ever Told.
Well done, well done. Well, it's good to know that your film is seen in all corners of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's shown as another view. Because this is the thing, you only get one view. That's the one event that you only get one view of it. You're never told the reasons why the Germans decided to fight. You're just told, oh, Adolf Hitler went mad and he hypnotized them. And that's it.
Yeah. And I can distinctly remember a comment on YouTube when the first parts were going up and somebody came on and said, I've never even heard of why he invaded Poland. He knew he invaded Poland, but he didn't know why.
Well, it's like when they say, oh, he invaded Austria. It's hardly an invasion. It's all exaggerations and covering up what really happened.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's exactly what happened.
Getting back to this here, the next quote I've got is about, because part of this, or the problems that they had, the rest of the church in the rest of the world, they were saying, well, what they're doing isn't Christian. They've got to treat the Jews well because it's not Christian to not treat the Jews well, which goes in the face of all the church tradition, which said that Jews couldn't marry Christians, Jews had to live separately, and all these laws that we've spoken about before that the Catholic Church actually came up with.
Is it right that the Christian identity, I think it's Christian identity, the ones in America anyway, who are pro-Israel, they tend to think that you have to be good to the Jews or God will punish you.
No, I don't. Anybody who's into Christian identity isn't going to be supportive of the Jews because they were seeing Jews as imposters.
Who's this lot with John Hagee and all that?
John Hagee, that Christian Zionists.
Right, they think we'll be punished if we're not good to them.
Christian Zionists are philo-Semites, aren't they? They're particularly enamoured by the Jews. But the problems that the Germans were having, and I mean, this got as as far as problems with the Catholic Church as well. I mean, what the Pope was saying was, you know, the thing that you're really doing wrong is you should be treating the Jews as neighbors and treating them as fellow Christians and all this sort of thing. And you shouldn't be looking out for the race. You should be allowing race mixing and all this sort of stuff, which the Bible doesn't actually condone. But the Christian Church at the time was becoming more and more liberal. So the way that I look at it, the Germans were actually getting closer to the real spirit of Christianity, and the churches on the outside were getting further from the real spirit of Christianity. And we can see that that's the truth, because today they've gone so far from it, they'll allow gay marriages in the churches and divorces and transsexual celebrations and all that sort of thing. But one of the things that they that these German Christians did was to explain why the preservation of race is a Christian duty, which is the next quote that I've got here. Moved by a deep aspiration to make the church, as Pastor Hosenfelder said, the soul of the Third Reich, the German Christians made a fundamental assertion. We see in race, folk, and nation the orders of life which are given and entrusted to us by God. The preservation of these is to us a law of God. This conception of the folkic basis of the Christian Church Universal introduced a new element into Christian thought. As the sun from heaven sends its rays over all flowers and wishes to bring each shoot to maturity according to its inner nature, to be a violet, the mayflower to be a mayflower, the rose to bloom as a rose, so the light of the Lord Jesus Christ shone over the whole world and wished to sustain every human being to realize his highest self according to his own kind. To preserve the purity of the race was therefore a Christian duty as the maintenance of the order of God. And that just seems completely logical to me. If God created the nations of the world and the different races, then obviously preserving those races is to do the will of God, to mix the races together so they no longer look like what God created is obviously to go against the will of God.
I'm along.
Yeah. And this is what the German Christians were saying. And this is what the international church was saying. Well, this can't be right. This can't be right. Yet they didn't attack it by coming out with new evidence or anything like that. They would just come out with, oh, well, they're heretics, or they're being nasty to Jews, or this is against Christian teaching. But it's not, because if you look at the language, you know, the higher self according to his own kind. I mean, that is the biblical language, kind after kind, race after race, not mixing kind with kind. So they saw that as it's your Christian duty to preserve your race. Part of natural law as well.
Which is why we find the EU bringing over these third world Africans, because they're building over there is a copy of Tower of Babel.
Well, they're trying to do the opposite, aren't they? They're trying to mix all the races together. And that's been the plan all along.
Yep.
I think it's been the plan of Freemasonry all along as well. I mean, that's always wanted world government, and everybody's got to be equal. And the next quote is about that, about diversity and equality. The first proposition of the creed must be emphasized. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. God applied to nature the concept of variety. And if men were obedient to God's will, then they would be careful to organize life according to the divine plan, or as Adolf Hitler says, the sense of the creation, which men have made into nonsense, must be restored. Equality before God did not mean equality of one to another. The organization of variety was the way towards integrated unity in life. So the way to get unity is to have variety, not to have everybody equal, because everybody isn't equal. And we shouldn't be trying to make everybody equal either, because things weren't created equal. All of nature is created into a hierarchy, and we have different races with different talents, different failings, and they're not all the same. And we shouldn't be judging one by the standards of another either. You wouldn't judge a cat by how well that it could round up sheep like a sheepdog does. And, you know, we shouldn't be judging these other races by the standards of ourselves. which is what they're saying here. And their task was to undo the mess that had happened, the mess that men had made. As Adolf Hitler said, men have made it into nonsense, and that sense of creation must be restored. So they're trying to get back to the world how it was created by God. And again, you've got Hitler's language here, the sense of the creation. So he obviously believed in a God that had created the world.
Yeah, I found out some information this week about the UN. They actually have laws already in there, but just not implemented, on the basis of need, which means if you were to go out shopping and you came back and you saw a couple of tents in your back garden, and you went to them saying, what are you doing here? This is my property. Can you leave? They say, no, we're not leaving, and you call the police. And when these laws come into being implemented, then the police will just come along and say, but they have more need than what you have. So the right is with them, because you have too much, which is the basis, obviously, of communism.
There, yeah, and that's not the equality that God was talking about.
That's right. He didn't know what has been poor, did he?
Yeah, everybody's loved by God equally, but that doesn't mean that everybody is equal one to another.
Can I just say as well, didn't they do that in Germany at one point when the Africans were coming in and they were asking Germans to give up their arms?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's the same logic today, isn't it? When they say that old people with coronavirus, old white people aren't going to get the ventilators, but young brown people that have just set foot in the country, they will, because they're younger and they're more likely to survive it. Never mind the fact that it's the old white people that paid for it all, that built it all.
This is why it's
not natural. It's actually the opposite of it. There's another quote later on about diversity as well, but it moves on from that to Christians of other races. Because, you know, we're told, oh, the National Socialists, they saw themselves as supermen. They were the Ubermen, and all these other races, they were untermensch, and they weren't as good as them, and they wanted to rule over them. It's nonsense. And this is the way that the Christians saw the other races. While the New Testament church was a church universal, it had nevertheless to be organized according to the racial order of God. The Jew remained a Christian brother, but of another race. The Jew must not say, I am a German, but I am a Jew. Baptized Jews could become evangelical Jews and worship in their own congregations. Likewise, in foreign missions, the object must not be to develop Western gentlemen, but only converted Negroes. It was true that in Matthew 28:19 there is the command, go and teach all peoples, but after baptism, nothing more was meant than that the Negro should be only a true and pure Negro, the Chinese a Chinese, as God intended them to be. So they weren't saying Christianity is just for us Germans, they were saying Christianity is for everyone. But becoming a Christian doesn't mean that you change your race or you change your nation, and you should worship with your nation and with your race in your own congregation, not mixed up here. And I mean, even earlier when it was talking about the body, you know, your body is part of one person. You couldn't, you know, sort of have a Negro arm and a Chinese leg and a Jewish neck.
I don't know. They come up with these things eventually.
But so they're saying the church is still universal, but it's made up of these different national churches within it, which is the original way the church was. That's still the way that Eastern Orthodox Church is. They have the Church of, you know, the Syrian Church, the Church of Russia, Church of Greece, Eastern Orthodox Church of Greece. I mean, to an extent, you could say that we still have it by calling it the Church of England, but then they go and bring that Church of England out to Africa, and they have African countries that claim to be Anglican, and they bring in black priests from Africa and say that they're Anglican and they're of the Church of England, when they're not. They're of the, you know, they're of the Church of Rwanda or the Church of Cameroon or whatever it is. So again, it's just very sensible. But they didn't like this. The establishment church outside of Germany really didn't like this, that they were saying, well, hang on a minute, it doesn't actually make him my German brother. It just makes him another Christian. And his Christian brothers are his Negro Christian brothers, not his German Christian brothers. So it's basically just common sense. But not it's not against them, is it? It's not supremacy.
No, well said that, didn't he? It's the German racism. They want every country to raise themselves.
Yeah, well, they wanted what they had for everybody else. They didn't just want it for themselves. And then it talks about foreign missions and charity at home. The intention of foreign missions should only be to show men the way to Christ according to the folkic nature of their community. The Church Universal was the organic unity of these folkic Christian communities. In home missions also, sympathy may mislead the true service to mankind. Charity may be so sentimentally administered that it will make a people effeminate. While aware of Christian duty and love towards the helpless, the German Christians demanded protection of the population against the unfit and elements of inferior value. Home missions must in no case contribute to the degeneration of the people, it was declared. Missionary enterprises must not become an economic adventure and must not become a retailer of goods. The service of home missions to Christ and to the folkic community must no longer rest on sympathy, but upon obligation. It was in the relation of the missionary command of Christ to the Jewish people that the movement saw a difficult danger to the folkic community. Aside from foreign missions, it had no justification for existence. We repudiate the Jewish mission as long as the Jews possess the right of citizenship and the danger of racial bastardization and deterioration exists. Marriages between Germans and Jews were to be forbidden, but non-Aryans might be admitted to the word and sacrament in German churches as guests when the necessity existed. So they could come in as guests, and the charity was for... Charity begins at home. The charity was for your own people, but not to the extent where the breeding of types with diseases, types that are likely to be alcoholics, types that are likely to be criminals, because to be a criminal often actually runs in the family. They didn't want to encourage them. They didn't want to encourage people to just live off charity. And they wanted this to be an obligation. They wanted people to see it as it's my obligation to look after my extended family. And that is the tradition, to the traditional way that our societies were run. We had this noblesse oblige. The nobles were obliged to help out the poor, and they saw the fact that they had poor people as something that was good, because it gave them the chance to be charitable. It gave them the chance to help these people out and to raise them up and give them a helping hand so that they could then help themselves. It was all based around that.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I think begging is now illegal now in Britain. I know the wife came out to Tesco the other day and gave a couple of quid and a Kit Kat to somebody who was obviously homeless, and she got warned not to do it because, you know, like I said, it's a scam. So,
you just dropped out there, Dennis. I think you might have hit the mute button.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I can't remove them. And also these days... I think you need a license to actually busk.
Yeah,
so you kind of make it difficult for people to actually be Christian.
And what they've done now is they've got the benefit system. So the state has taken this over. In the past, it was the church that did this, and people were obliged to help out. They were obliged to either give money to the church that would then be shared out among the poor, or they'd be obliged to help out directly to the members of the poor. Whereas now the money just gets taken in taxes, and it gets given out by the government, and it's given out to foreigners. It's given out in such a way that it discourages people from getting married and having a family, because you're not going to get so much money if you're not a single mother, say, because you've got the husband there. So there's encouragement there to cause degeneration, and that's what they were saying. That's anti-Christian. It's to cause a degeneration in the people. It's got to be anti-Christian, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's true, because I saw a Home Office, just for immigrants, really, somebody sent it to me, and it said that any immigrant who comes to Britain, if he wants to receive benefits, must apply for a house, which will be available for him, which would just encourage him to stay and live in a house and claim benefits.
And that's taking it away from the people whose house it should be. It's taking it away from the children of the nation. If you're giving out houses to foreigners, then that house has got to come from somewhere. It's being taken away from our children who will grow up and need a house. And instead of having a house, 20% of the houses have all been given away to the foreigners. More than that, even. If you look at all the houses that are being built now, they say, well, we need all of these. If we didn't have the foreigners here, we'd have enough houses that were already here. So every one of those new houses they're building is for a foreigner, because all the population increase is being driven by immigration, by the people that have come here. And we've got so much of it now that every house that is being built is basically for someone foreign.
Yeah. I mean, they moved my family's out of London for a while, didn't they, up into other areas like Birmingham. And it was just, obviously, now London is what it is like, but there's less whites there all the time.
You know, there's another verse as well in the New Testament. I think it's with a Canaanite woman, and she's asking for morsels of meat. Or she's asking for a blessing, and Jesus said, "Well, it's not meat to give the children's food and give it to the dogs." And she says, "Well, can I just have the crumbs from the table?" And it's essentially that with the charity. It's not good. It's not good to take the food from the children and give it to somebody else. That's for the children, and that's what our charity should be. It should be for our own people, and that is the Christian way. And it's become warped, and it's become so. It's draining our resources and giving them away to all these others. And again, when they talk about these missions, they mustn't become retail adventures, which is what the church was used for a lot. Was to go into the third world and convert them, and then they'd set up trading posts and they'd sell them alcohol, and in exchange they would take slaves back to America. And you know, we all know all these stories about buying things from the natives for beads and what have you. That's what they were saying. We don't want any of that going on.
Well, never actually forgive Thatcher for taking milk off kids.
There you go. There's an instance of it.
Wasn't Christian.
It's an instance of it. Next they move on to Freemasonry. A Christian church rooted in the Folkic order and repudiating the spirit of the Christian World Society was the ideal to be striven for. It must seek to overcome the corrupting tendencies of the times, such as pacifism, internationalism, and Freemasonry. Membership of a Protestant clergyman in a lodge of Freemasons should not be permitted. So these were all the ideals that the German Christians were striving for within the churches. Basically, to repudiate the spirit of the world. Again, it says death to the world in the Bible. It says, you know, we should refute the world. So they wanted to repudiate the spirit of the Christian World Society. No, it doesn't say the materialistic Jewish spirit, the Christian World Society, because Christianity had become so corrupt. And that was the ideal to strive for, and against internationalism and Freemasonry. So they openly knew that Freemasonry and internationalism and pacifism were all working together. The pacifism so that countries could be taken over in the name of internationalism, which was this Freemasonic goal. And churchmen were involved in this.
Yeah.
Which they are today, as I mentioned earlier, with Justin Welby, who promotes globalism and reads about human rights from the pulpit instead of reading from the Bible.
Exactly, and plus the Freemason core of not giving up a fellow Freemason, which is why a lot of the Catholic bishops and whatever were known to have committed paedophilia are not being given up, because that's the rule of Freemasonry.
Yeah, there's nothing in Christianity that says, "Oh, you've got to lie to cover up for other Christians." It says you've got to be honest. You know, and you've got to tell people if they've done something wrong.
Yeah.
The opposite of Freemasonry. As I said, we've got another bit on equality here in the next quote. Faith must always be in the mission of the people seeking to work out the commands of God. The essence of divine creation was diversity, and equality before God never means equality among one another. There have been efforts to make men equal. The idea of humanity, as it was nursed by the 19th century philosophers and as it was valued in circles of Freemasonry, took its point of departure from the false supposition that the ideal type of international Superman could be created through spiritual and intellectual education. The counterpart of this man, who belonged to humanity rather than a race or a nation, was found in the proletarian of Karl Marx, who issued the command, "Working men of the world, unite." He wished to create an international herd and destroy the folkic nature of the divine order. The third fallacious concept of the equality of man was found in some Christian circles who pointed to Galatians 3:28. There can be neither Judean nor Greek. There can be neither bond nor free. There can be no male or female, for ye are one man in Christ Jesus. This interpretation overlooked the fact that the Apostle Paul was not seeking to repeal the divine differences between races and sexes, but that he would give Christ to all. In summary, the faith movement of German Christians would create a single Protestant church organized on the principle of leadership, as in the days of the apostles, and make the terrestrial framework for the kingdom of God the folkic community, which is the unity of kinsmen of like blood living on their native soil and expressing their life according to their own folkways and traditions. So it's interesting that they bring up diversity, their true diversity. The essence of the divine creation was diversity. And we go against that essence by trying to mix people together, which is what we call diversity today. It's not diversity,
yeah, it's twisted, division. Nicked another word, aren't they?
Yeah, it's division. What they've given us today is division. They've divided us by mixing in all these different people in among us, which goes totally against the natural order and against the divine creation. And he's pointing this all out back then in 1930. And that verse still gets used today, taken out of context. I mean, if they're saying that it means that there's no difference between Judeans and Greeks, there's no difference between male or female, it's what they're essentially saying is that, you know, transsexualism is okay. That's certainly not what Apostle Paul was saying.
No.
That when you become a Christian, you give up being male or female, or you give up your nation. That's not true. Baptism doesn't change your race. Do you want to comment on that, Dennis? I've got to have a cough.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say about it puzzles me when gays sometimes claim to be Christians, because obviously, well, in my eyes, it goes against what Christianity was all about, but it's kind of twisted that one as well. And then the Pope jumps on the bandwagon and he endorses it, and suddenly, you know, and that's another law bitten the dust.
Well, that's totally against everything, isn't it, to say you can have gay Christians. I mean, it's like saying, well, you can have active Christian murderers. I mean,
it's satanic Christians.
Yeah, or satanic Christians. I mean, it's explicitly forbidden to engage in sodomy in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. It talks about it in the New Testament as it being a punishment. So, you know, to say that you're engaging in that, it means that you're going against God.
Yeah, well, somebody said once, I was listening to them, and they were an expert on Satanism, and they said that wherever you find Satanism, you usually find homosexuality. His words, not mine.
Well, yeah, because it's a reversal of the act which gives life, isn't it? It's a reversal of it, and it's a desecration of it as well. So it would form a part of these black masses that they would have. They would have a black mass would be, or a Sabbath would be like a sex orgy, and as perverted as you could get it. And when we were looking at Aleister Crowley, that's why he was involved in all of that. Because it was reversing the order of nature, and then thinking that because of doing that, because that would cause shock waves in nature, that you would somehow gain some kind of supernatural power from that.
Mm. Well, very weird.
The German Christian movement succeeded. The victorious advance of the German Christian movement and its practical merger into a unified Protestant church in the native land of Martin Luther is a unique story in political and ecclesiastical history, At the present time, a very intimate relation exists between the National Socialist Party, the German Christians, and the German Evangelical Church. And this was written in 1935, as I say, by a disinterested observer. He's not a supporter of National Socialism. He's just trying to be objective and describing what the views were at the time. So they were successful in getting the church to be like this. And you can see that from the pictures where they've got the cross and the swastika together. And we might as well start on some of these 28 theses. And as I was saying earlier, there was this black propaganda saying that Rosenberg had come out with 28 theses for the Reich Church, including people would sing hymns to Hitler, they would pray to Hitler, they would get rid of the Bible and put Mein Kampf on the altar instead. All this nonsense. And you still get people today that believe that, sometimes even nationalists, pagan-type nationalists, that will bring that up and say, well, look at this, they were against Christianity.
Yeah.
And it's quite clever, really, because you can find that the German Christians did have 28 theses, but you can't find them anywhere. All you'll find is references to Rosenberg's ones. And what we've got a summary of them here. None of them sound like worshipping Adolf Hitler. The first section is church and state. The theses are divided into four groups. In the group defining the relationship of church and state, it is repeated that the German Evangelical Church stands within the state. It cannot remain neutral and cannot aspire to be a church above the state, as the Catholics assert for themselves. The relationship of the church must not be one of treaty, but of mutual confidence. The church confesses its allegiance to the principles of blood and race, and holds that only those who enjoy the right of citizenship can be church members. Only those persons of Aryan blood who can hold state offices can be church officials. The Christian of another race is not a Christian of inferior rank, but rather one of a different kind. Acknowledging race as the creation of God, the church must preserve this pure and healthy. Marriage between races of a different kind is a slab against the will of God. So interesting there. So obviously they weren't quite ready to join up with the Catholics, were they? They were still looking at them as...
No, I think Hitler tried at one point.
This has always been an accusation against Catholicism, is that the Vatican is it's outside of the nation. It's a loyalty that people have instead of to their nation. It's a loyalty to another sovereign nation, because the Vatican is a sovereign state. So mm-hmm. that is an accusation against them. And the Protestants here are saying, look, we are not. Like that, and we see ourselves as part of the state. The proclamation of the church is the second one. The second group of principles deals with the proclamation of the church. God, it is held, demands the whole man. The proclamation of the church has as its object the placing of man under the will of God. As the Church of Jesus Christ, it has the primary task of proclaiming this to the German man, who is created by God as a German. And they proclaim to him the gospel of Jesus Christ. The gospel of Jesus Christ means that God is our Lord and Father, that this God was revealed in Jesus Christ, and that we human beings find the way to the Father only through Jesus Christ. God places man in the life order of family, folk, and state. Therefore, the Folkic Church recognizes in the claim to totalitarianism of the National Socialist State the call of God to family, folk, and state. And by state there, they mean nation. The nation was the state. The state was the nation. The National Socialist hierarchy were at the top of it directing things, but it's essentially the same thing in fascism, isn't it? You know, it's all that bundle of sticks together make up one. So the nation together working as one becomes the state. The state is the container that withholds the nation and holds it all together and protects it. And you find that reflected here in this proclamation of the church. The next one is the foundations of the church. The third group of propositions in the program consists of the foundations of the church. The foundations, it is held, remain the Bible and confession, not Mein Kampf. The Bible contains the message of Christ. The confession bears witness to the message of Christ. The decisive revelation of God is Jesus Christ, and the document of this revelation is the New Testament. Hence, for the proclamation of the Church, the New Testament is the norm which gives meaning to the message of the pulpit. The Old Testament, however, does not have the same value. The specific Jewish folkic customs and morality and tribal religion have been overcome. The Old Testament remains important, nevertheless, because it hands down the story of the decline of a people which, despite God's revelation, continually separated itself from him. The prophets who are so conscious of God showed to us all in this people as an object lesson this fact. The attitude which a nation takes towards God is decisive for its destiny in history. The German Christians also confess that in the Old Testament they see the apostasy of the Jews from God, and in this their sin. This sin is revealed to all the world in the crucifixion of Jesus. From that time the curse of God has rested upon this people until the present day. The principles also affirm the recognition at the same time in the Old Testament of the first rays of God's love, which was finally revealed in Jesus Christ. For the sake of these facts, the Folkic Church cannot repeal the Old Testament. The contents of the Christian proclamation are witnessed in the Augsburg Confession and other creeds. Through these creeds, the Germans are bound to their fathers in faith. A church without a creed would be like a state without a constitution and laws. A confession, moreover, is always in a particular epoch bound up with its problems. Certain questions which the creed of the fathers answered no longer exist. Likewise, certain questions which the confessions of the forefathers could not yet answer are placed before men today for solution. We undertake, concludes the section, from the confessions of our fathers to find a creedal answer of the Folkic Church to the questions of our age, not by going back to the faith of the fathers, but forwards in the faith of the fathers. So there's a lot there, and I would suggest that the Old Testament is just as important as the New, because it has all the prophecies in there, and it's the credentials of the New, is the credentials of Christ. But what they're doing is they're looking at it and they're saying, we use it for looking at the bad behavior of the Israelites in the Old Testament. And there is bad behavior in there, and there's bad behavior from the Canaanites, and lots of bad behavior. But what they don't realize is really themselves. It was their bad behavior, because the Germans were Israelites. But they're still not saying we're getting rid of this. They're saying, look, we point to the bad behavior in it, you know, they killed all the prophets. I mean, that's what it says in the New Testament. You know, I've always said the Bible is anti-Jew, and even, you know, the National Socialists, some of whom wanted to get rid of the Old Testament, still knew that it was against the Jews. It was pointing out the bad behavior. And finally, the way of the church. The final section deals with the way of the church. First of all, it directs itself against liberalism. Liberalism weakened the faith in Jesus Christ because it sees in him only a man. It knows Jesus only as the proclaimer of a high morality, or only as a heroic personality. It places the human reason above God. To us, Jesus is the Son of God, and his appearance is the miracle of human history. The Folkic Church also directs itself against a new orthodoxy. This orthodoxy closes to the struggling and seeking man the way to Jesus Christ through the rigidity of its dogma, and hinders a vital proclamation of the gospel. But the Folkic Church directs itself in particular against the efforts towards replacing the Christian faith through a religion which is formed out of racial life. While religion as the seeking and quest for God is racially different, Jesus Christ is in his wonderful person the fulfillment of all that which is vital in the human soul. The quarrel as to whether Jesus was Jew or Aryan does not arrive at the nature of Christ. Jesus is not the bearer of any human type, but reveals to us in his person the character of God. Hence, the German Folkic religion can only be Christian. Christianity has different stamps according to race and Folkic life. Hence, the German Christians struggle for the realization of a German Christianity. This German Christianity was embodied in Martin Luther. In Luther's Reformation is seen the breaking out of a German Christian faith. German Christianity is Lutheranism. As German Lutherans, we are wholly German and wholly Christian. At the present time, all kinds of things are asserted about man which are delusions. Delusion number one is this, that man is able to redeem himself. Slavery to sin, the coercion of fate, and the power of death are alone overcome in belief in Jesus Christ. Through him we receive the forgiveness of our trespasses. That is the Christian message of salvation which man needs for all times and all peoples. That salvation is found in the cross and resurrection of Jesus. This proclamation, which lands the real God and the real man, takes the real God and the real man seriously, prevents the return of materialism and liberalism by the roundabout way of religion. Christian faith which does not become deed is worthless in a folkic church. The act of the Christian faith is a decisive struggle against all that is evil and is a courageous determination to serve and to sacrifice. Hence the folkic church understands, under the term positive Christianity, point 24 in the National Socialist Platform as this: belief in Christ, redemption through Christ, acting from Christ. Such are the individual foundations of German Christianity on which German men can in faith unite. So it points out the bit in point 24, that's how the positive Christianity is to be understood, as we've gone into before.
As we always assumed.
Yeah, but it just shows you, you know, they were Christian. They had love for their fellow man. They weren't supremacists. They weren't trying to replace bits of the Bible. They weren't trying to make war on others. They weren't seeing themselves as supremacists. They were Christians, and this was the main movement in the Protestant Church. Anyway, we've gone a little bit over time here, Dennis. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truth Without Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you, even if you are in self-isolation.